So I want to push back against that a little bit. Push back against your pushing back.
And you please, know, Ian and Kendra, jump in to this like tag team.
I'm thoroughly enjoying watching you two push back.
Equal and opposite reaction.
It's kind of fun.
We're standing on the sidelines going, fight, 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 fight.
Get him. Take him out.
I need to go make some popcorn.
Or some pie.
You are listening to the Down the Wormhole podcast, exploring the strange and fascinating relationship between science and religion. This week, our hosts are...
I'm Kendra Holtmore, a PhD student at Boston University, and if I could instantly become an expert in one instrument, it would be the violin.
Rachel Jackson, rabbi at Agudas Israel Congregation in Hendersonville, North Carolina, and if I could become an expert overnight at any instrument in the world, it would be the violin.
Ian Benz, associate professor of elementary science education at UNC Charlotte. And if I could become an expert in any instrument overnight, it would be the violin.
I'm Zach Jackson, UCC pastor in Reading, Pennsylvania. And if I could instantly learn one instrument, it would be the cello, because I want to be like everyone else, but still a little bit different.
And now we have our string quartet.
That would be fun. So today we want to talk about, you know, how do we and society in general communicate in maybe effective ways about communicating what evolution is, science and religion in general. And so that's kind of our hope for today is to talk about how what we've noticed from others. What are some ideas that we have? Have we used any strategies that have worked? What were they? So, Zach, if I can single you out first, I know that you've taught some or done different presentations and conversations at different church settings and different public forums about evolution. And I know specifically more about human evolution, but what have you experienced and what have you noticed has worked and not worked for you?
I have. After I finished the Sinai Synapses Fellowship, I felt like I needed to then take that out into my context. And my context is a pastor in southeastern Pennsylvania. And pastors don't generally talk about these things. In fact, at our conference meeting the other day, which is like 160 churches in the area, we were talking about putting forth two major initiatives for the conference. And one of them was climate change. And somebody stood up and said, well, I don't really know about that. And it's a very politically divisive issue. And nobody in the churches want to talk about it anyway. And I had a few things to say about that, but they cut me off right before I got to the microphone. Because it's true that people don't want to talk about it because we don't want to get into fights because other people have made it political when it's really not. The way that if I give my son my phone to play Mario Kart for a little bit and I get it back, my phone is suddenly sticky. Even if he didn't have anything on his hands, somehow he has made it sticky. A politician touches something and then suddenly it's sticky and now we can't talk about it. And that's
perfect
stupid.
Analogy.
Yeah, that is a good analogy.
Oh, my life is all just sticky things. So I put together a couple of seminars to go around to churches. I told all my pastor colleague friends that if this is something you want to talk about, evolution, whether that's cosmic, biological, or human, climate change, mental health, and a whole, I have about a dozen of these. And if you would like me to come to your church and be the bad guy, great. Even though I'm not really the bad guy, and it won't be as controversial as you think. But if you'd like some amount of plausible deniability that you didn't know what I was going to say, but you think it still needs to be said, I will come. So I have struggled to try to figure out the best way to explain these things for a couple of reasons. Number one is that they are self-selecting groups. So the people who come to these seminars already are educated or care about these things. I have never had any seminar in which some adamant vocal opponent was present because they're just not going to show up. And so everyone who came patted themselves on the back and told me how great it was and how much they learned and how they can't wait to tell someone else about it. And that didn't do anything. And secondly, I've learned that people don't care about facts so much. Charts and graphs really don't do anything. Nobody has ever been converted by a pie chart. That's just not the way that we work.
And but a Venn diagram.
That's the way. Oh, but a that Venn could get diagram.
If it's a real pie.
Gospel.
Ooh.
Pie
yeah.
Real pie.
People have been converted by pie.
Yeah.
Like, let me change your mind. Here is an apple.
Here's
pie.
A pie. If you notice, it's you know cut what? Not, in a particular way.
When you say it like that.
Would you prefer the pie that 97% of it still exists, which is representative of the climate scientists who agree with that climate change is a human-induced problem, or the 3% pie? Which one? That's what we need to start doing whenever we talk about this stuff.
But I,
so sorry, Zach. We
thank
totally
you,
derailed you.
No, it's true though. I mean, and the only times I've ever had conversations in public forums with people about these sorts of topics that divide us are like on Facebook with friends of friends and cousins of cousins and people I don't know who then feel like it's okay to be really argumentative and bombastic, and we're not gonna disprove anything. We're not going to convince each other of anything. And no matter how many times I try and how much time I put into it, it just seems like it's just yelling into a hallway, just chasing after the wind or something along those lines. So I guess what I have done is, first of all, I have spoken mostly about this on Sunday mornings because I have a platform. Literally, I have a platform I stand on and a pulpit I stand behind, and people are already there. And they're there for a different reason, not just to hear me talk about evolution or climate change or whatever it is. They're there because it's church. And so I have a built-in audience that's different. And I then try to tell it in story form. So when I talked about evolution recently, I talked about the Kai Wolf that I mentioned a couple weeks ago, that hybrid, and you can start to see evolution happening in real time. Instead of talking about the primordial ooze and all of that, I tried to tell a story that people could relate to. When I talk about climate change, I don't talk about CO2 levels and emissions levels and all of that. I talk about rocks that I found in my backyard and how we see historically temperatures changing. And yeah, and I don't know if that's effective. I honestly don't have any data, any response from people that they said, you know, I would have never thought of it that way, but now that you said it, now I'm on board. I haven't had that experience. I haven't had anyone kick me out of a room. So I don't know how effective my teaching style is, but that's kind of my MO as a preacher.
If I can just add one thing real quick.
Please.
When you look at the research in education research about teaching, you know, it's fairly clear that people learn best when you can figure out a way to relate it to something they already know, right? So to help.
Okay.
So when you talk about something that's really abstract, it's tough for them to kind of see. It's the whole mentality that is it going to impact me directly type thinking. So, you know, I'm not saying it declares that what you're doing is perfect, but as in that people are hearing that and going, oh yeah, it relates to me, because there are other things at play. But to me, that is a very effective strategy to help them. You know, so when we're teaching children, we know we need to figure out a way to make them understand concepts or help them understand concepts. And a great way to do that is to relate it to something they already know or have experienced.
So how do you explain evolution to children other than through Pokemon?
Yeah. So it depends on the age, obviously. The younger they are. I mean, so I've heard some science educators
argue that when it comes to elementary age children, we shouldn't be teaching evolution at all. And I fundamentally disagree with that. When you look at our standards documents, for example, it you may not, when they're really young, get into specifically, here's what evolution is, children, but you start providing the foundation so that when they do get into more complex issues, they at least have that foundation if done correctly. When they're really little, there are some really great trade books that have been introduced. So little like picture books and things like that, that people have created to help them understand different aspects of evolution. So yeah, there's lots of hands-on activities and those types of things to help them understand, you know, what does adaptation mean? What is natural selection without going into detail about natural selection? Hmm. That kind of stuff.
I created in seminary, I had to do a thesis, and it was on teaching science experiments paired with Judaism, is what I ended up doing. So going into a Jewish preschool and teaching them different science experiments and relating the two together. So reading a book such as Benny's Pennies, who's this kid collecting pennies, and then he buys things for all of his family members. And then we did a science experiment where we had to clean pennies with ketchup and cola and water and soapy water and all that other stuff. So I think there's lots of different ways that you can make it very age appropriate. But I also think that we kind of give kids the short end of the stick when we think that they're not capable of understanding, when it's really our problem of being able to communicate. So there's this whole series, like astrophysics for babies, quantum mm-hmm. physics for babies, chemistry for babies. And it's by Chris Ferry and Julie Kregenau. Pardon the pronunciations. So they're teaching these like really college level concepts to babies. And these are wonderful books, and kids get it. They don't get the entirety of it, but they understand far more than I think we give them credit for. So that just sort of like when we talk about any topic that adults feel uncomfortable with, kids actually, I think, seem to get more than we do. So there's another book like The Red Crayon, and how that talks about different understandings of the body. So for evolution, we can talk about looking at the diversity of life that we see and just appreciating the differences and the subtle differences that there are, and saying, oh, I wonder why this one looks this way and it's a little bit different than that one, right? Why do we need a red robin and a cardinal? Why do we have a red robin and a blue robin or a blue jay, right? What do these give us? And doing so with no judgment, I think that's crucial. Just allowing the questions. And Ian, you were saying, you know, you have with kids, you have to relate it back to something. And Zach, you were talking about making stories because it's a little bit easier. But I kind of want to go with Kendra's point of actually just having pie, where having pie, and really what that means to me is that we're willing to sit down and eat together. People love to eat together. So having something in that way, but also the symbolism of a pie is love and relationship. So when you create a relationship, whether or not the actual ability to relate it to something that they already know or relate it, right, make an analogy, it's the relationship itself between the two entities that are talking is what's going to drive the conversation. So that's how I understand how we communicate. But the issue, Zach, that you were talking about is being in an echo chamber. How do we ensure that we're not in our own echo chambers all the time? And I think the best way to do that is to actually be in relationships, so that it's not, you know, a fourth friend of your cousin that you're talking to on the internet. That's not a relationship.
And that's my as a communicator, this is my broad question, my broad problem that maybe y'all can help me with, or you listeners at home who have some great ideas. If I want to communicate something important, about one of these topics, I have a couple of ways I can do that. I can say it on this podcast. I can write it on my blog. I can write a book. I can stand out on the street corner and scream, I suppose. I am a preacher after all.
Make sure you bring your Bible to thump on.
I have my great-grandfather's Bible thumping Bible from his evangelical days. I could bring that. That's been thumped a few times. But how can I, as a communicator, communicate effectively with people who disagree with me when there are really no forums for that kind of communication? Mm-hmm. That people who disagree with me are not listening, like who disagree fundamentally with me on the basic tenets of what we're talking about, aren't reading my blog or listening to the podcast necessarily. Though if you are, I love you and I want to talk to you.
That's why I always feel very interested when you talk about the programming that you put on for your churches and like always do sciencey things and draw it into your lessons, but also like when you talk about teaching anything about like evolution or some other scientific topic, climate change, it just strikes me as very odd because odd in a good way, because that
put that on my business card. Clarify that.
You are odd in a good way. But it strikes me as odd because it's so unfamiliar to my experiences in churches personally and just in general. I can't really think of a church that does that. And so it seems like a very unusual model for church. And so I guess I'm interested if this is really just you as a pastor and like the passions that you have really like manifesting that for your congregation, or is this like a model of church that you have seen in other places in your life that you wanted to bring into your pastoral style? And I feel curious about it because I just think that when I was growing up, church was never really a place for like education other than like reading scripture, but scripture was kind of like spoke for itself, I guess, is like how it was usually taught. And I remember feeling really frustrated as an undergraduate student because I finally started learning like other things about like historical context and like these other external sources for interpretation, you know, like the things that you do in school that for people who like never went to seminary or never even like went to college, it's easy to feel skeptical of those intellectual tools of analysis and interpretation. And I understand that, but it's just strange because I never really had a formal education on evolution at all until I was a graduate student. Even as an undergraduate student, there it was like accepted or assumed in some of the science classes that they think they would have taught evolution, but it just was still kind of this weird subject that nobody really wanted to address. And, you know, it was like easy to access. You can just like look up stuff online or you like, you know, you move out of the house and learn that people believe in evolution. So it's there, but it just wasn't something that was like formally handed over to me in the ways that I'm hearing all of you talk about until I was like well into my higher education experience. And so it just was an absent conversation. And I think that relates a lot to what you're saying about how if there's like a fundamental disagreement, people don't really want to have a conversation because they're not interested in trying to convince each other. It's like a different category of disagreement. The fundamental kind, you can't compromise on those things because they're about your foundational values and principles and beliefs about the universe. And that's different than having like some kind of democratic debate where you don't really know what you think. And so you can be convinced more easily.
Right. We could have a debate on here right now as to when the Australopithecine species ended and when the Homo species started. And we could all disagree and have a grand old argument, but we're not going to have the fundamental argument about whether or not those fossils were placed there by the devil to tempt our faith. We're not going to do that. It's a fundamental difference. And I think a lot of my pastoring has been trying to be the pastor that I needed. And I've been challenged, not externally, more internally, to be more than that as well. Because my inclination is to just be the pastor that I needed. But I also need to realize that I also need to be the pastor that other people need who aren't 10-year-old Zach. And to be able to make space for all of them while recognizing that obviously I can't be all things to all people. But so I can't just get up there every week and give a science lesson with a little Bible bow on top of it, which isn't my style anyway. But I think that just because it's such an important part of me, it just comes out more naturally. Mm-hmm. You know, like you have those pastors who are really into golf, and so you get golf analogies all the time. Which, by the way, while you're here, why is subpar bad? isn't it good in golf to be below par?
Yeah. The further below par you are, the better off you are. Right.
The best golf players play the least golf.
Just like we talked about a couple weeks ago, because English is ridiculous.
Yeah. Any golf fans out there want to explain to me why subpar is bad? You can leave that in the comments, please, because I genuinely am curious. And I'm not a golf person, so I don't ever give any golf analogies. I instead will talk about how rainbows are not real and that they are an illusion. I know, right? Listeners at home can't see the disgusted look on Rachel's face. Rainbows are just a story that your brain tells you about a very specific chunk of the electromagnetic spectrum.
But they're so pretty.
Sounds real to me.
Yeah.
You can't take our rainbows away, Zach.
Do not take away rainbows.
Don't touch the rainbow.
I mean, can it be real, like, but wait, it also
unicorns
not
are real.
Be real.
Rainbows are real. You know? Don't be messing with these things. I have a fundamental disagreement
with
you.
This is the second time. The first time I trash talked rainbows in this podcast, I heard a lot about that afterwards. Yeah. People really love the rainbows. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. It's all a lie. Or at least an oversimplification.
Yeah, that is a different... There's a very big difference of semantics of oversimplification and lie.
There is no malicious intent behind the rainbow lobby. So anyway, if we can move on and please get to unicorns, because I really want to talk about them.
I like you mentioned lie and misleading, though, and that there's a difference in the meaning of those two words. And
Real quick, Ian.
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just, before we moved away from this, because I wanted to ask Rachel, I saw you like nodding your head as Zach was like relating his experience. And so I just wanted to ask, does that resonate with you? And in what ways is that different for you being a rabbi, for your congregation? Like, what does that look like for you?
No, that's, I certainly was nodding along, and what Zach was saying resonated very deeply for me. My difference is that I came from a liberal, again, talking religiously, a liberal background, and I'm in a liberal context. And in Judaism, our foundation is arguing and discussing and debating. So that is a slightly different foundation. Also, I was a practicing chemist for about 10 years before I joined the rabbinate. And so, for example, when I have a class at the synagogue, right, just a regular lunch and learn class, you bring the lunch, I bring the learning. And we'll just sort of go off onto a tangent of what is a rainbow. Or so when we were talking about the covenant in Parsha Noach, in the story of Noah, and, you know, God puts in a rainbow, it was like, well, let's really look at what a rainbow is, but also let's look at the grammar of this word. And so we seamlessly move back and forth between the grammar of the words, the experience that we have, and then our just general cultural understanding of, you know, God put a rainbow in the sky and is it so beautiful and we're never going to be washed out again.
Now, your Hebrew is obviously a lot better than mine. It is the same word for like a hunting bow.
It's a hunting bow. Yeah, it's a war bow.
So this is like,
it's not a pretty
putting his weapon down mantle and saying, all right, I'm done hunting you.
God, exactly. God put up, yeah, God laid down God's rifle.
Because I've said that before in sermons. And
yes,
I am always worried that somebody who knows
you are correct
more. Okay.
So I have that experience. But I was also nodding because it is a very fine, fine line between being the clergy person you want or what you need, what you needed, and being the clergy person that your congregation needs you to be. There's another rabbi, Rabbi Rachel Behrman, who, with another rabbi, Rabbi Paul Kipnis, who jointly write, they call them Midrashic monologues, the stories that are untold for the people in our scripture who we really want their stories to be told. And Rabbi Behrman said I think she put this on the blog or on their website. It said, these are the stories that I needed to hear when I was growing up, and I realized I have the power to write them. So I think there's a lot of power in that. But as we've talked about, you know, way back at the beginning, right, and part of our conflict language, which is sort of what we're dancing around right now, is conflict language. Who is the authority? Who is telling you what you need to hear, what you want to hear, and what trust do you have in them? And I just go back to the idea that when we're in relationship with one another, then we're able to have those deeper conversations. And our challenge is to take one step at a time, right? I'm not going to be able to talk to a person who is fundamentally opposed to my existence as a woman clergy or as a Jew. That's just not going to happen. But I can talk to somebody who struggles with that idea. I can talk to somebody who wonders about that. Or I can talk to a friend who says, you should talk to my other friend. And we get together in the same room and we have pie. Again, it's rarely actually pie, but it should be.
It's all about the pie.
Pie is good.
3.14159. It's all about pie.
I have a friend who's the pastor of a church that has a pie endowment.
Oh, you've told us about that one.
Have I?
Oh, yeah.
You have.
When they want to have any kind of a gathering, there is
perpetual
money in the budget for pie.
And
that's amazing.
Only for pie, can only be spent on pie.
Yeah. Because it's not the same thing as a cookie.
Question for y'all's is...
Y'all's.
Rachel and I are clergy. We have a built-in diverse platform. Congregations that are gathered together not simply based on common beliefs or common worldviews. So there is a diversity built into that, which is splendid. And I'm finding more and more that it's unique. And as organized religion in the United States and Europe, and it is in sharp decline, fewer and fewer people are going to church or are part of a church. That platform is diminishing. What can take its place? in terms of being able to communicate broadly to people who don't agree with you already before you start. Mm-hmm. Like if I were to start up a group at the library and I were to give presentations every week about different topics, that group would then be pretty self-selective, right? It would just be people who want to hear what I have to say. So that would be self-defeating in another echo chamber. So what can possibly take the place of churches and synagogues and places of worship?
Well, clearly not the internet. Clearly not the internet, because you never read the comments. Don't read, because what you find is the echo chamber and the anti-echo chamber, which really should be a thing.
The anti-echo chamber.
Yeah, it's kind of like antimatter. Because if you make a comment online about something, you're either going to get the person who's like, yeah, I totally agree with you, or you're going to get the person who's like, blasphemy and heresy and down with you, and you know, let's go after this person.
Or you represent all evil and you're going to hell. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, the anti-echo chamber, where the person is actually just talking to other people like them, but inside your echo chamber, just to hear their own voice. There's no actual communication in the comment line, so I don't think that that's the place. But I do think that it's still based in community. But I using my phrase that I have been using throughout this podcast, I'm going to push back a little bit. I don't think that as much as we believe that religious organizations are diverse, I think, right, we're diverse socioeconomic, perhaps ethnically, perhaps age and stage, but I don't know if we're really all that diverse when we look at the world in terms of religion and worldviews and values. That's why we have a bazillion and one different religions and offshoots of religions, because we don't agree and we never have agreed. And I don't think it's this term echo chamber is new in the 21st century, but I think we've been doing the same thing all along. And I mean, we can go back 500 years and see, that's where the split, right? That's where the split happened in the Church of England. Or we can go back 1,000 years and say, oh, well, that's where that split is. And we just keep going back. And at some point, it's always a split. And if you go back to, if you start with the stories in the book of Genesis and the book of Exodus, why are those laws there? Because they're making a split for the cultures that did actually do human sacrifice, right? When Abraham and God are chatting and God's like, hey, you should kill your son. And Abraham's like, but I have two sons. It's like, nope, you just have one that you love the best. Sibling rivalry constantly in the book of Genesis. And it's like, you should sacrifice your son. And Abraham starts to, because that's what he knows. But it's like, no, that's the change. That's the reaction. That's the opposing that we're doing. And if we believe that those stories happened 4,000 years ago, there's nothing to stop us to say, why didn't they happen 10,000 years ago? Right? Why did, if we look all the way back to, you know, the origin of the Homo sapiens, why did they start wandering? Was it really food, or did they just have a disagreement? And they said, you know what? I'm going to walk away from you. I don't want to talk to you again. And they found themselves 100 miles away, and then they kept going. Ian and Kendra, jump in to this like tag team.
I'm thoroughly enjoying watching you two push back.
Equal and opposite reaction.
It's kind of fun.
We're standing on the sidelines going, fight, 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 fight.
Get him. Take him out.
Let me sit up straight.
I need to go make some popcorn.
Or some pie.
So yes, oh, yeah. We have always been divisive and divided, and it is totally our jam to split ourselves up. That's what we do. But we have never had the almighty algorithm to put it on overdrive before. The Facebook has been completely transparent with the fact that their algorithm prioritizes your feed in terms of what will make you most angry, because it will make you engage and it will help sell ad revenue. The algorithms are doing this. Every single social media platform out there does not give you chronological feed. You have to search through the settings to find chronological feed. What they all want to show you is their main feed, which is the carefully curated, most controversial, most angry, most polarizing, whatever. You get that plus the people who are intentionally doing that, looking at you, Vladimir Putin, and you end up... I'm not actually looking at Putin. I can't
but
see him.
Careful, though. He may be one of our fans in Russia. Right? So, you know.
We do have a couple of listeners in Russia.
He could be
so
one of them.
So, if you're listening, shout out Vladimir Putin.
That's right.
I could use some of that oligarch money, but just like the clean ones, not the...
Yeah,
anyway.
Help us out.
Anyway. Woof. That got weird.
odd, but in a good way.
What was I saying? See, this is the Russians. They're doing it to me again. They're yeah. confusing this conversation.
Okay,
no, so that's right.
You were saying we haven't been as divisive. Right.
The internet amplifies the ridiculousness that humans have always been.
Yes.
And it makes us... It enables us to be so much worse than we've ever been. But it disguises it because it's done, you know, through a soulless calculation that, for example, that most of these job searching websites have algorithms that run through your resumes to find the best candidates for the company that's paying them, which, you know, I'm about to trash talk them. So this will be the only podcast that ZipRecruiter will not sponsor. So this podcast is not brought to you by ZipRecruiter because they use these algorithms that comb through resumes to find the right applicants so that you don't get 10,000 applicants. You get 20 that are great for you. But those algorithms are based on previous employment performances, which were based in prejudiced hiring practices. And so if you're just going by the algorithm, you'll end up with way more middle-aged white men who have been way more successful because they've been given way more opportunities to do so. But then it makes it seem like it's just a calculation. And so it's not biased, it's not prejudiced, it's not evil, but it's amplifying it. And the more that we use it, the more data gets put in, and the more the algorithm then amplifies our previous bias. And it takes the divisiveness that we've always been, gives it a veneer of respectability, and then makes it 1,000 times worse, exponentially so, on into the future. And so I think that we are in a unique place in that we are still as divisive as ever, but we have tools to make us more divided.
Yes, I don't disagree with what you have said. You know, in the analytical chemistry, and not just there, but garbage in, garbage out. Right, what you put in your algorithm is what you're going to get out of it. And if you keep doing it, then that's what you're going to keep getting until you find a point where you multiply by zero.
So a church is a place where there's no algorithm.
I disagree entirely with that.
Really?
Yes.
I see, because I have so many people in my church who are there because it's their church. Because they've been there for 50 years. And it's their family church. It's their local church. They're there for the choir. They're there for the fellowship, for the people. The pastor is like the last of their concerns. And so they have just developed this diverse group of people. Diverse in as much as Protestant Christians are diverse. Obviously, I shouldn't even say that, because we have some people who are regular attenders of the church who don't even believe in Jesus. Though they don't publicly say that, but they've talked with me. But I see the diversity in my church, and I can't speak for every church, but I see it, and I have to own it and claim it and say that that's unique in the establishments that I am a part of.
Can I just say what I'm noticing in this disagreement? And I don't know if it'll be right or if Rachel and Zach will
agree that this is what's happening. But it seems like...
Are you noticing that I'm right?
Well, I'm noticing that it seems like Rachel is talking more about socioeconomic diversity and Zach is talking more about theological diversity, but that you both are using the word diversity and it just maybe means slightly different things in the way that you are speaking about congregations.
I'm talking about worldview. So,
which could be wrapped politics, up in theology.
Ideology, theology. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not necessarily socioeconomic diversity.
Yeah. So maybe y'all don't and actually disagree as much.
Not as much as it might showcase. I mean,
don't get me wrong. But I'm still over here saying, fight. But
yeah, exactly. I
throw out that.
So that went in there. I agree that the term diversity is very nuanced and we need to be specific about which kind of diversity. I do believe that faith centers can be socioeconomically diverse or ethnically diverse, often more in Christian branches than in Judaism. But I think from a theological standpoint, I actually don't think there is that much diversity. And I say that because, and please correct me if I'm wrong, right? Zach, you came from a place of very fundamentalist, the earth is much younger than it actually is, and people are lying to you. And the people that are coming to your church, regardless of if they've been generational, if any of them have that view, right? I wouldn't presume that the people in your church have that view and would have hired you, right?
There are a few.
Young earth creationists.
Yep.
Okay. Then when you talk, they probably either just don't show up or just don't listen because, right, there's that, I think I've told this joke before here, right? Plony goes to synagogue to talk to God and Joe comes to synagogue to talk to Plony, right? That people are there for different reasons and so they're not listening to you.
Put that one on my business card too. They're not listening to you. Just put that on my wall. I am blessed, and I will say my congregation is fairly unique in this. I have not been a part of very many churches that have been like this, that I have had fundamental disagreements about issues of God and scripture and culture and politics and all of those things with people who have felt comfortable enough with me as a person to talk to me about them, to schedule a time to come to my office or to come to my open office hours at Panera every Friday, which are if you're in the Reading area, feel free to come on over, and to have these disagreements with me. Or sometimes I'll get emails a couple days later with their pushback. But and I don't know if this is because of the relationships that I have with them or just the people that they are or the fact that we are such a local community-based church. Our name is Community UCC, after all. But I really, truly believe that we are able to hold that tension pretty well. We held an informed voter series during the 2016 election in which we had presentations on various politicians' standpoints and policies, and we had respectful conversations. And there were like diehard Trump supporters in the room. There were Bernie fans in the room. I mean, we had all kinds who had conversations about policy and not about mudslinging. And I was so proud because I don't think most of the churches I've ever been a part of could have pulled that off.
And was that with primarily your own congregation?
It was entirely my own congregation.
So it wasn't outside people.
We opened it up to the outside, but nobody came.
So to me,
which I don't blame them.
Yeah, what that signals to me though is trust, the whole trust issue, right? To me, that's what a lot of this comes down to, is that there is a level of trust in the environment that you're in, where people can come together and disagree, and still, at least communicate in some way later on, typically, right? Mm-hmm. But you have to have established that trust first, usually, in order for that to be successful. You know, I would not expect it to be where you could go into a church that you have no connection with. You're not connected with anyone at that particular religious space, and you just go in there and start talking, and that everyone will immediately listen to you unless mm-hmm. you start saying a lot of inflammatory type things. And then, of course, they still won't trust you and want to run you out. And so it made me think about this scientist that I met when I was at Virginia Theological Seminary back in September. And her name is Nalini Carney. I probably am mispronouncing her last name, and I'll send you the information, Rachel. But she is a forest ecologist and professor of biology at University of Utah. And what I found so fascinating about her story is that she was talking about ways that she could get into, you know, religious communities and to be able to communicate about her work and the importance of forest ecology and conservation and those types of things. And what it all came down to was establishing some sort of connection and level of trust with a leader in those particular places, or already having a connection with someone who was viewed as a leader in a particular religious space who then vouched for her. But she, you know, acknowledged that she went to many different places to try to be able to, you know, have an opportunity to address the congregation. And this is the general public who was affiliated with that particular religious space. And most times it failed until she was able to finally get herself into a place where someone she knew personally could vouch for her. And then that opened the door in other places. And it was all because of her having a connection with someone who could vouch for her. And then other institutions seeing that, oh, she's someone who can be trusted. So I will vouch for her, even though I don't know her, but my friend knows her. So, you know, let's bring her in here. And it was all about trust, but it mm-hmm. took time, you know? So, you know, we wouldn't be able to take our messaging into a place that we don't know anyone right away. Typically it will not be successful because they don't trust us yet.
So that brings me back to my original question to y'all's, that if I am no longer a pastor and I no longer have this platform and this people and the trust there, how then can I communicate these kinds of ideas and truths to people who fundamentally disagree with me? Is it possible?
Yes.
Without becoming a teacher?
Yes. Well, I think, again, even if you're not technically a pastor in a church anymore, you're still a pastor. It's still part of who you are. Even if you step away from it, there is still a chance someone will recognize you as that, which does, in some cases, bring a level of trust again. Right? It may make people a little apprehensive, but they're maybe somewhat willing to listen. I think we can get our message into communities that right now would view us as, I mean, maybe enemy is too strong of a word, but as opposition. It's tough for us to get into those communities right now, but I think we can if someone already in that community can vouch for us and let people know that while you may not agree with this particular person, I trust them and value their opinion, value their message. To me, that's always the easiest way, or at least the quickest way. And then you're on your own 2 feet, right? They have to open the door for you. You need to take it. And then they are putting themselves, you know, they are, it is a risk for that individual.
Kendra, how would you answer Zach's question too?
Will you ask the question again?
It was basically affirming that I have a unique position as a pastor to communicate with people who may fundamentally disagree with my positions on scientific topics, like evolution, climate change, the divisive ones. And without this platform, without this pulpit, I find myself more in an echo chamber of like-minded people or people who are opposed to me on the internet who are not going to engage with me. If I do not have this platform anymore, if I'm not a pastor, which I'm assuming most of our listeners are not, how can they also have this kind of communication?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm speaking for myself, I would say that I, with each passing year, become more pessimistic about like online communication, which is a shame because it really is such an accessible platform to be able to like talk about anything on social media. And it, I mean, it's like the greatest accessibility for people and yet the worst when it comes to like actually carrying out meaningful substantive conversations. And so I mean, that's, I think, part of the reason why I'm trying to be a teacher, a professor, is that I really, even though this is a more inaccessible resource, I really like the space of a classroom and the format of trying as a teacher to present information that is fair to, you know, whatever side of the argument. If you're talking about like evolution, I one time gave a lecture to a group of students who were from varying backgrounds. I actually think that there were probably maybe a few more creationists in the room than I would have anticipated for like a Boston, Massachusetts classroom. But I gave a lecture on Darwin and talked about like the basic tenets of Darwinian evolution and different varieties of creationism. And someone is knocking on my door and goodbye.
Her message was so good.
Jesus is knocking at her door.
Knock it off.
Behold, I knock.
I think I hold optimism.
Yep.
And I try not to be pessimistic. And so I try to use history to help with that, to say that while we might be experiencing the woes of being human and living in society from a more exponential scale than our ancestors did, what we're going through is really not that much different either. I mean, Zach, one of the things that you love to point out is that Jesus was a real big rebel and fairly unliked in some circles. And he was trying to spread a message. And here we are 2,000 years later, trying to stop that message from being adulterated and misused. But the message got spread like wildfire. So we don't know. I also don't believe that we know our own impacts. Again, bringing this back to the concept of evolution, the evolution of thought. We don't know what our contributions will be in 50 years, 100 years from now, because that's what society and environment will give us. To know if this idea is going to be good for the environment, if it's going to be naturally selected. And so I think we're just going to continue. And these fights that we have, these disagreements that we have, will continue the passion to be engaged with other human beings. And as long as we have that passion to be engaged with one another, there will be ups and downs. And, you know, as the optimist, I believe that we'll end up on the up.
Kendra was giving us a downer, and so Jesus knocked at the door so that Rachel could give us a high note.
Yeah, sorry. The plumbers are here to install the new oven. But
Jesus is a
I thought it was a carpenter.
Mario is a plumber.
I guess what was I even talking about? Yeah, I guess in answering Zach's question. Oh yeah, my pessimism about the internet. Yeah. I think really just that in my experience, it is really important to like actually communicate substance rather than just like getting angry and which often leads to ad hominem attacks and whatnot. But I think that there's something really valuable about being able to present two sides of an argument and be able to just like show people information
so that they can see that information in like a non-judgmental setting and then like make an informed choice. And I totally understand that what I'm describing is very idealistic and that that's not how it often plays out. But I think that's still what I hope to try to like be for people and to do in my own teaching, because I don't know what else to do but give people information that seems fair and true, because I have not found anything else that works. So, and this is why I don't engage on internet forums when I'm arguing.
Be the internet you want to see in the world.
Yes.
This has been episode 19 of the Down the Wormhole podcast. If you found value in the past 6 months of podcast, then please do us a favor and share your favorite episode with some friends who might appreciate it. Long holiday drives are the perfect time to discover new podcasts, make new connections, and share pie with your loved ones. Like me. Share pie with me, please. Yum. You can find contact information, show notes, and more at downthewormhole.com. So we're going to be taking the next 3 weeks off to be with our various families, lead our various holiday services, cook our various pies, and celebrate the 20th anniversary of Y2K, however it is that somebody celebrates Y2K, maybe with floppy disks or something. Either way, we'll see you again in 2020, when we'll begin our mini-series on human evolution. We have some great episodes lined up with some accomplished guests and fascinating topics. 2020 is going to be a great year to go down the wormhole. But until then, no matter what holidays you celebrate, and however it is that you do that celebrating,
you are odd in a good way.